Thanks, Nathan. Welcome back, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Last week, officers from three different police departments were involved in fatal violence perpetrated by and against them. How do we make sense of the deaths of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling at the hands of police in Louisiana and Minnesota, or of the murders of the police officers in Dallas? We're joined by two very thoughtful scholars who've written two very compelling books on race and culture in America. Dr. Eddie Glaude, Jr. is a professor at Princeton University, where he teaches in the Religion and African American Studies departments. He's the author of Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. He joins us on the phone from his office in Princeton, or rather, actually, you're from the studios at NBC in Manhattan, because you've just been on Morning Joe. Is that right, Eddie?
Yeah, actually, I'm in a car on a cell phone, so I apologize
for the
quality of the sound.
Well, wherever you are, we're glad you're with us for now. We appreciate it. And Dr. Lester Spence is here with me in the studio. He's Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is called Knocking the Hustle: Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. He's here with me, as I said, in studio. Wait, morning, Lester. It's good to see you.
It was good to see you, too.
So, Eddie Glaude, this morning on Morning Joe, and I hopped on the elliptical at the gym, I saw you talking about equivalency. You talked about President Obama and the fact that he was drawing equivalency between the actions that happened on Tuesday and Wednesday and the action that happened on Thursday of last week. What do you mean by that, and what do you think that means for this discussion about police brutality and police misconduct?
Well, you know, actually, I didn't have a chance to nuance the claim. Part of what I wanted to suggest is that in the past, President Obama, when talking about issues of race, has always engaged in what I call and what others have called a strategy of equivalence, where on the one hand, this is what black people experience and feel, and on the other hand, this is what white people experience and feel. And to the extent to which he's talking about kind of the ugliness of white backlash, of racist comments or whatever, as being rooted in the kind of economic insecurity of white fellow citizens, to kind of equate that with the sense of vulnerability and precariousness rooted in the persistence of white supremacy in the country, I think is a dangerous thing to do. Now, to say that is not to say that he was making that move with regards to Dallas and what has happened with Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, but the way in which he presents it, it feels like the strategy of equivalence, right? That there's Dallas and then there are these two events. And it seems to me that that's just part of the problem. We need to get at the specificity of policing, the crisis in policing, the vulnerability and precariousness of black life in relation to that crisis, and talk about Dallas separate from it as a consequence of, in part, but as separate from a much deeper conversation about the context for the murder of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile.
I have you on the phone, Eddie, and I have Lester here in the studio, two of the finest, most thoughtful black scholars going in the country today. And I want to read for you a little bit from another very famous and erudite black scholar. It's Michael Eric Dyson. He wrote a piece that appeared in the Sunday Times yesterday, but it was online on Thursday. And it was originally online with the title, What White America Fails to See. And he begins that version of this essay saying, it's clear that you, white America, will never understand us. We are a nation of nearly 40 million black souls inside a nation of more than 320 million people. We don't all think the same, feel the same, love, learn, or even die the same. But there's one thing most of us agree on. We don't want the cops to kill us without fear that they'll never face a jury, much less go to jail, even as the world watches our death on a homemade video recording. You will never understand the helplessness we feel in watching these events unfold violently, time and time again, as shaky images tell a story more sobering than your eyes are willing to believe. The title of that essay and the beginning of that essay was changed a few hours later after the events in Dallas became known. And so the essay was changed from What White America Fails to See to Death and Black and White. And he begins that version by saying, "We, Black America, are a nation of nearly 40 million souls inside a nation of more than 320 million people. And I fear now that it is clearer than ever that you, white America, will always struggle to understand us. Like you, we don't all think the same, feel the same, love, learn, live, or even die the same. But there's one thing most of us agree on. We don't want cops to be executed at a peaceful protest. We also don't want cops to kill us without fear that they will ever face a jury, much less go to jail, even as the world watches our death on a homemade video recording. This is a difficult point to make as a racial crisis flares around us." So Lester Spence, Michael Eric Dyson, tempering his rhetoric in light of what happened in Dallas. The headline in the Times yesterday, one of the headlines said, "Black Lives Matter was gaining ground, and then a sniper opened fire." Have the events in Dallas changed radically the conversation about Black Lives Matter and about police misconduct?
Well, I think it's really important to understand that movements, whether you're talking about Black Lives Matter or movements like Occupy Wall Street, they have a long durée. Kind of, they last far longer than a Twitter feed, far longer than something we click on Huffington Post. So I think the events in Dallas are probably going to complicate things. But people, looking at Maryland, people have been organizing in Maryland against the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights for several years now. Finally, they've gained a little bit of traction, and that bill has been on the books, I think, since 72. It's that type of granular activism directed to change public policy, that's not going to change. And maybe it's a two steps forward, three steps back move, given what happened in Dallas. But I don't think their fundamental hurdles haven't changed to getting that type of legislation repealed.
Mm-hmm. And Eddie Claude, what do you think? Has the conversation changed, and should it change at all, given the evolution of our understanding of the relationship between communities of color and the police, you know, going back from Trayvon Martin through the present? Obviously, if nothing had happened after Trayvon Martin, it would have been a very different conversation we'd be having now. But the fact is that things have happened hundreds of times since the death of Trayvon Martin. These incidents continue to occur.
Right. So, I mean, if I agree with everything Lester just said, right? And one of the things that we do know is that, you know, over 200 people were arrested in St. Paul, 100 people, 102 people, 120-something people arrested in Baton Rouge, right? That we still see organizing and protesting taking place around the country, around policing, and all the other issues that surround the issue of safety in our communities, right? And I think part of what we have to see is that the events in Dallas, they change the context of those actions, right? I mean, one of the things that we see, for example, in Baton Rouge, is that the events in Dallas really allow for or enable an easy kind of legitimation for a certain kind of response to protest. But it's not going to, as Lester said, it's not going to change what organizers on the ground at the granular level are doing. The fact that we need to argue for misdemeanor decriminalization, that we need to begin to talk about eliminating the criminalization of poverty, right? A range of things that impact the way in which our communities are policed and openly surveilled. So the only thing that I say that will change post-Dallas, right, is the context within which we continue to do the things that we've been doing all along.
That's Eddie Glaude. He joins us from New York. He is professor at Princeton University. His latest book is called Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Dr. Lester Spence is associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins. His latest book is called Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Lester Spence is with me here in the studio. Lester, there's a African-American police officer who wrote a piece in Vox a week or so ago. He said, on any given day in any police department in the nation, 15% of the officers will do the right thing no matter what's happening. 15% of officers will abuse their authority at every opportunity, and the remaining 70% could go either way, depending on who they're working with.
Yeah.
What do you think about this theory that police misconduct is a matter of a few bad apples? You know, most police are great. There's just a few bad apples. You buy that?
Yeah, no, I don't. There are a few different policy moves that happen since the 70s. So one is you see an increased use of police to expropriate, to serve as kind of a revenue generator. We definitely see that in Ferguson. We see an increased spending on police. We definitely see that in Baltimore from 1990 to 2015, police spending has increased from $140 to $450 million, while other levels, what spending on other issues remain constant. And then we see the increase in broken windows policing, right, where it's like people are basically jailing or giving people, putting people basically in a joint or something close to it for misdemeanor type stuff. These dynamics incentivize police officers. Oh, and then, you know, again, and it's harder, you know, and it's a legal apparatus where it's harder to try them. These dynamics incentivize officers to basically do whatever they want under the guise of law. And there's no way. I mean, you if we were to open up the post office, if we were to give post office that type of open license, we'd see massive malfeasance, right? So I think that what's happening, I think with that police officer, he's probably understating the degree to which police departments in urban and other areas have just become places for people to violate the law.
Eddie Glaude.
That's a really important point, Lester. And part of it has to do with us resisting the reduction of the crisis of police to a crisis of intent, that we need to find the bad apples who intend to act badly. When we reduce the crisis to simply intention, we lose sight of the structural reality that Lester just laid there. And what we have is not only incentives, as Lester just stated, we also have a kind of culture, a culture that in some ways makes the other 70% complicit with the 15% that are bad, quote unquote. I'm just using that data as an example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or as my starting point. So part of what has to happen, right, reconsideration of the way.
Yeah, and Eddie, you're cracking up a little bit. We're losing you there for a second. But, you know, Lester Spence, is this a problem that can only be fixed by police? For example, Eddie writes in his book about when Michael Brown was killed on the 9th of August in 2014, 62% of white St. Louis County residents said that the killing was justified. I mean, is this just a police problem or is it a larger cultural problem in both communities of color and white communities?
It is a larger cultural problem, right? That it's not just that police are in one way, one could argue that they're fulfilling the democratic will of white citizens, you know, thinking about the title of Eddie's book, that they're fulfilling the democratic will of white citizens. But it's still broadly a political issue, right? And I think that it is incumbent upon police, given that culture that Eddie talks about, to do at least some of the heavy lifting to unpack the cultural dynamics that caused them to be even more likely to be to violate the law or to violate kind of the ethical spirit of the law.
And Eddie, you've written about what you call racial habits.
Right.
So the racial habits that are in place across this country, both in urban, suburban, and rural areas, I mean, what is the answer? How can trust between police and communities of color be restored?
Well, it's going to have to be restored, I think, from beginning with policy, not just simply with kumbaya moments of calls for unity in the midst of crisis, right? People tend to reach for the kind of classic example of desegregating the military forces, right? Once the segregated armed forces, then you have orders passed down, and now it's one of the more integrated institutions in American life. So we're going to have to address this via policy, right? We're going to have to address it in terms of eliminating fees of bail. Most people who are in jail are people who couldn't afford the bail, right, particularly around misdemeanor charges, right? Sandra Bland would be alive today if she had $500, right, to pay the bail to get out. We need to address these issues at the level of policy, and then once we address these issues at the level of policy, then they can begin to have an impact on how we think about each other. This is why I talk about habits. When we talk about implicit bias, It begins in the inside of our heads and the inside of our hearts and then moves to structures. I want to talk about habits because you change habits by changing structures. So you move from the outside to the inside. So I think we need a fundamental, and Lester's work has done this. I mean, he really alludes to this in terms of his systematic critique of neoliberalism and its impact on the general ethos of living in this country. We need to really, really fundamentally challenge, I think, how we're living, because the way we're currently living is no longer sustainable. It's no longer sustainable, and we will continue to see the kind of unrest, the kind of instability, the kind of protest, the democratic awakening that we're experiencing all over the country until we change our
system. Right. And Eddie, we're having a little more trouble with your phone here, but let me turn to Lester. One of the things, and you are a father of a few kids.
More than a few.
Right? More than a few. Right? How many is it? Four, five kids.
Five, yes. Three boys.
The talk that you and black parents have had to have across this country for generations now, how has that talk changed in terms of what you tell your sons and how they, what advice do you give them to interact with law enforcement, given, for example, the fact that Philando Castile apparently did everything right? I mean, he was informing the officer of what he was doing and that he had a gun and so on. And of course, the lawyer for the officer, Officer Jimenez, who shot him, said that the race had nothing to do with it. It was the presence of the gun that had to do with it. And that's obviously going to be his defense. But how do you as a dad revise the talk given what the events of last week?
You know what? My oldest son is about to go to Michigan in a few weeks. My middle son is 16. I've never given them the talk, and I'll tell you why. I think that at some level, what we have to begin to do is we have to begin to act as the citizens we believe ourselves to be. And we don't act as the citizens we believe ourselves to be if, when we encounter police, we act as the second-class citizens they treat us as. So to the extent that there's, I don't believe in the whole trust thing. I think Eddie's right. But to the extent we can socialize police on a micro level, we socialize them to act right by acting as if we're citizens. So I haven't given them the talk. I don't plan to.
Eddie Glaude, your reaction to that?
Well, you know, I just wrote a letter. My son and I just published letters in Time magazine about our response to the murders of Sterling and Castile. And I understand exactly what Lester is saying. In fact, I find it compelling, but I gave my son the talk. He's a rising junior at Brown. And I must admit, I'm afraid for him, even though I want him to walk around the country not as a second-class citizen. I want him to believe himself to be a fully vested and all of the benefits and burdens of citizenship in this country, but I do understand what it means for him to encounter the police under any circumstances, that it could very well be the last time he breathes, and that worries the hell out of him.
Yeah, as well it should, and it worries the hell out of an awful lot of people. I appreciate both of you joining us this morning, and we will continue this talk, to be sure, as the weeks and months unfold. Thank you so much. Eddie Glaude is a professor at Princeton. His new book is called Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. Dr. Lester Spence of Johns Hopkins, his book is called Knocking the Hustle Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. We've got a link to more information about both of these very compelling books on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, a review of the latest offering at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me to talk about the Three Musketeers. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.